Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Variety, celebrating 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
It's like a very basic acting thing where it's like the king doesn't tell the audience who the king is. The court tells the audience who the king is, right? Mm-hmm. It's how everybody else around him acts that lets people know who's the status. And Timmy immediately like went into the role of, this is my dad who I love more than anything, you know? And so he kind of allowed that dynamic to really flourish in a beautiful way. And then he and I just became really good friends. We were playing music all the time. But what I'm referring to specifically in the scenes themselves. And I just thought that was just a really special thing, because I feel like you can believe that dynamic when you see it on screen.
Latino actor and producer Oscar Isaac is one of the most sought after stars of the moment. But his focus remains on his family and time, which he knows he can't get back. I'm Clayton Davis. On this episode of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast, we talk to Oscar Isaac about his performances in Warner Brothers' Dune and Focus Features' The Card Counter, which he received lead actor buzz out of the Venice Film Festival. Also on this episode, we talk with one of the stars of The French Dispatch, Jeffrey Wright, who discusses working with Wes Anderson and his upcoming turn as Commissioner Gordon in Matt Reeves's The Batman opposite Robert Pattinson. But first, it's our roundtable minus a Schneider this week, talking women of color in the Best Actress race and the buzz for Ben Affleck. It's all happening on Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close. Well, hello, everyone. This is Clayton Davis, Film Awards editor at Variety, here today with Janelle Riley and Jazz Tanke, because there's no dad here today. It's
what
Home Alone.
What did you do to him? Where's Michael Schneider?
Where is he?
Home sweet Home Alone. Look at this. Coming soon to a Disney Plus near you.
I think he's taking a very well-deserved vacation, but I'm not sure.
Wait, what's that word? Vacacion? What's crazy? Hi, ladies. It's good to be in your presence today. And by presence, Zoom still.
Yeah, and you both have much nicer rooms than I do and better lighting. And I'm starting to feel inferior.
My window's open. That's like the only reason why. It's getting chilly in L.A. By chilly, not chilly.
Welcome.
Broke out the weighted blanket for the first time this year. Oh, pretty exciting. God.
But by chilly, it's 59 degrees. That is the current temperature in L.A.
That's a good degree. That's not chilly. It's just like, it's good. It's brisk. It's fall.
L.A. cold.
It's brisk, baby. Yeah, especially for L.A.
So let's talk about these smooth jams of the week of Oscar hunting, because that's what we do. We Oscar hunt.
Oscar hunting.
Let's talk Parallel Mothers closing in New York Film Festival last week. Pretty good reviews coming out of there. Pedro Almodovar. Not Spain's Submission for international feature.
What did he do to them? Why?
Listen, in all fairness, I have not seen that Javier Bardem movie yet. Maybe it is a better movie.
Oh, is that what they selected? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But isn't this, don't they sort of have a tradition of this, of not picking
films? He's been chosen a lot, you know.
Okay.
He's been chosen a lot and then not chosen a lot. So, I mean, I get it doesn't have to be Pedro every single time. And God knows what else gets submitted in the running. But yeah, that was a curveball. Listen, either way, Penelope Cruz is going to be in the actress conversation.
That's great.
And I think Pedro will be amongst the contenders for original screenplay. And, you know, he pulled the lone director before for Talk to Her in 2001 when they didn't choose him that time either.
I agree. This is one of her best performances in a long time. Like, it's classic. It's almost like early classic Almodovar Cruz performance.
Yeah, I think this is, yeah, this is her, because I love her in Volvere so much. I think that's always been her best for me. And I think this might be her second best.
So they chose her husband's movie over her, huh?
Do you think it's spicy at home?
I doubt very much. I think those two are perfectly unbothered by anything else other than their beautiful, perfect lives.
They. By the way, no one's picked up her other movie yet, Official Competition, right?
Really?
I don't think so. I figure anyone will pick it up, like, I'm not going to pick it up for this year. I'll wait till next year. So that's interesting.
All I know is if the Academy nominated Penelope Cruz for 9, they clearly love her, and I would not be surprised to see her nominated for this.
Yeah.
Can I just say how much I didn't know I needed to see Penelope Cruz, like, make that potato omelet that she makes in the movie? Like, she's just cutting potato. It was like, that alone is such a good scene.
But. Yeah. I always quote a friend of mine that says, you know, when you look like Penelope Cruz and you see her in a movie and she's like struggling, you're like, go be a model. Like, go.
It's just that easy, kid.
Like, just go be a model. Like, what are you talking about? You're not going to struggle. You look like that. So that, I always can't take her seriously in that way now. But no, but I do.
I have a friend who actually kind of looks like her. It's been pointed out multiple times. And she was telling me a story. Her friend, her name's Nicole. She was like crossing the street one time and this like homeless guy kind of started yelling at her. Was like, hey. And she like whipped around, was like, what? And he goes, you look like Penelope Cruz. I was like, that's hilarious. I love that this guy is like, you know, in her early Spanish work with Almodovar, you know, not the more recent.
Oh, man. Moving to this week now, Last Duel opens in theaters.
Have we all seen it?
Yes.
Whoa, we're all on the same page here.
Okay.
This is good.
First of all, starting the campaign for Ben Affleck for Best Supporting Actor, he makes a series of choices that in so many ways shouldn't work, and yet they do. He is so fantastic. The audience I saw it with, I really had to marinate on this for a couple days because you don't want to say it's a fun movie, but it is very clever and subversive. And I think that, like, I appreciated it more as time went on and saw, like, some of the things where you weren't sure if it was okay to laugh that were very satirical. And I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
But the more I think about it, the more I just think about what a clever movie it was.
So I have two thoughts and two theories with this, right? And it goes exactly to what you said. It is, if everyone doesn't know, it was written by Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, and Nicole Holofcener. And they have said that Nicole wrote the woman part, and then Ben and Matt wrote the male parts. But the movie is structured is the same story told from three different perspectives. And I'm curious to know if Ben wrote that second perspective.
Me too. Yeah.
Because going with what Janelle said is that he steals the movie. And this is why I think it stands out. Him and Matt Damon, in theory, should not be playing these parts because they are period pieces they don't necessarily excel in because they're very Boston contemporary people. Because Matt and Ben are doing this their own thing, and Adam Driver seems to be the only one that understood the assignment, Adam Driver ends up like sticking out like a sore thumb and taking the background completely. And Ben is just running circles around him in that second sequence.
Gonna disagree with you on that, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah. No, yeah. I agree. I like Adam is so good, but Ben is way better in that. And you laugh so much at him. But Jodie Comer, I'm sorry. Jodie Comer is such a great actress.
She's fantastic. I thought she really had a heavy French accent based on Killing Eve. I didn't know that, you know, it was, she that wasn't her real accent.
I still can't tell you what to what her normal voice is.
Me either. It's, you know, when the movie starts, it's jumping around in time a lot because you see the Matt Damon point of view first. And it was a little jarring. And then I realized that that's the way they have to do it because you're going to see it. You know, it's done in that, Rashomon style. Rashomon? Is it Rashomon or Rashomon?
Rashomon? I don't know.
Rashomon. Or as I kept calling this movie, Rashomon. So like that really pays off. So it was a movie that, like, again, the more it went on, the more I appreciate it. The more time I've had away, the more I appreciate it. I don't know if they're, I don't know if it's being like sold as an awards movie. You know, it opens this weekend and I haven't heard much about it.
Yeah, so I, God, and this is the, like, and I also, like, I think I'm definitely lean on the like it side. There's definitely issues with it, and I think the structural making of it was the right approach, but it's also really long. It's like 2:30 or something like that, and by the time you get to Jodie Comer's perspective, which is like the beating heart of the movie, you're so exhausted by that point that it's hard to like kind of give yourself to that part of the story. And the awards talk has been muted because I don't know what it's going to do. I think it could get a couple texts, and Ben has the tender bar, which we'll talk about in a second. So, and Jody, I think, is just going to have a hard time trying to crack anywhere near a lead actress race. So that's it. Yeah, I don't know what you lead with. It's not populist. It's not going to make $100 million. So what are you doing? I don't know what crowd is.
If we come back in a week and this movie made $100 million over the weekend, you have to eat your shirt.
I will eat my shirt. The shirt.
I don't know. Shirt. That's the punishment.
Yeah, also, again, I put it in my piece titled "The Miseducation of Ben Affleck" because I think people have labeled him a bad actor, and we need to stop that. He's not. He's a great actor. Studios need to stop relying on the MPAA to give information regarding sexual assault in movies. And we need more trigger warnings somewhere for people to see.
I mean, I think if you go into you're right. People should do their due diligence. You know, if they know what this movie is about, like, but also realistically, we know they don't a lot of the time you're at the movie theater and you're like, what's playing?
Yeah. Just something at the top, you know, or like a symbol on like the poster, just something that like we need to, cause I'm just being sensitive to anyone that like goes into this and sees a rape scene twice. So twice.
I know that it's also incredibly violent overall. Yeah. The duel itself is, you know, and like for me to like even bring up violence and when we see so many violent movies, this is I hats off to Ridley Scott, who keeps coming up with creative ways to kill people.
Yeah. It was definitely the Ridley way to do this. Like, it was the most Ridley like he was like, I can see why he was attracted to it and just went for it.
Oh, yeah. No, he's those battle scenes, like, yeah. You know, I think also I wonder if some of the response has been muted because everybody's waiting on House of Gucci and they think, you know, that's going to be Ridley's play. But, you know, what if it's not? Just throwing it. It probably is, but I'm just throwing out there. What if it's not? Like, he deserves attention for Last Duel. He did a really good job. Yeah.
Rumored House of Gucci, rumored to be 3 hours and 15 minutes.
I had 2:30, but
yeah, whatever the rumor, somewhere in between that. But only Ridley gets to make 5 hour movies between two movies.
Oh, you're challenging Scorsese. He's going to come out next year. Flower Moon is going to be 5 hours long because you said that.
4 hours. Yep.
Taking the day off work to watch the new Scorsese movie. No, I think with Last Duel, I was one of those people, hands up, I saw it early and I didn't do my due diligence on it. So, yeah, had there been a war, my first reaction coming out of that was it was intense because I didn't know what was happening. But, yeah, Ben is great. Where it lands in crafts, I think I agree with what you just said. People are going to wait on House of Gucci, and I think that might be the one where he and his crew get all the love. But who knows? He could get a double.
Breaking news while we were recording, because we were just talking about Pedro not getting selected for Spain. France has just selected Titan.
Yeah, saw that.
Wow.
I mean, are we really surprised?
Yes.
I felt like that. Yeah. Okay.
No.
Okay, just because of...
I thought they were going to select Happening. I just thought they were... Listen, I love Titan. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
But that, again, talk about another trigger warning, by the way. But, but yeah.
I'm the person who thinks that Titan could go all the way and get a Best Picture nomination. So, you know, maybe it's crazy, but yeah. Neon did Paris, did the Parasite campaign. You know, I'm seeing a similar reaction to Titan that I saw to Parasite in the early days.
Awesome.
Watch this space.
Watch this space. So Tender Bar with Ben Affleck, that could be his Oscar vehicle because he's so good in it. And he's...
It is a supporting role?
So it's support. Yeah, super supporting. He's very good. It's a really good George Clooney outing. And it's something I had noticed like afterwards is that George Clooney, I think, since Good Night and Good Luck and maybe his entire career, you could be a George Clooney fan and not like the same movies that he makes, because I don't think he has a signature aesthetic to his movies.
No, not at all. It's kind of what I love.
Like which I love about him too, which, like, listen, Midnight Sky, I think, is his best movie, and then people didn't like that. And the same people who didn't like Midnight Sky will say Suburbicon was great. And I'm like, oh, no, not really. But we'll stand for this
Leatherheads erasure.
Yeah, and there's people who love Leatherheads and some people who don't, like, so yeah, it was interesting in that way. So I think Affleck adapted screenplay possibly on the table, and I think Christopher Lloyd is actually really great in it, and I wish he would get his Oscar moment.
Christopher Lloyd, it's so weird, he's finally the age to be playing roles like Doc Brown, which he shouldn't have been playing 20-30 years ago, and he's so good. He never got attention, you know, from awards people in the past when he was like so consistently good in everything. So anytime he pops up in anything, I'm so thrilled.
Yeah.
Christopher Lloyd love.
Yeah. Christopher Lloyd love till the end. All right. And end on some best actress talk. My column this week deals with women of color, not factoring into the best actress race. There seems to be, and not saying that there's a lack of women of color, because there are women of color in films this year, just Oscar, we know Oscar and they don't look that way, or, you know, what's, you know, overtly obvious. And of the four acting races this year, I find lead actress to be the weakest. I think it's really top heavy.
Quite a few in supporting actress, but you're right. I'm not seeing many front runners, I guess you would say, in the lead actress race.
Yeah, what's funny, though, I think supporting actress is the most competitive of the four this year.
Oh, my God. Already it's insane. Mm,
that's crazy. Yeah.
And still so much left to see. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have just quick check-in on contenders. I mean, Kristen Stewart for Spencer. Depending on your mileage, Jessica Chastain, I think, is in the hunt very much so for The Eyes of Tammy Faye. We've got Frances McDormand enter the conversation at in New York with Tragedy of Macbeth. Olivia Colman is
that
Olivia
is
Colman.
A supporting role.
What? Frances McDormand?
Yeah. You don't think that's a supporting role?
No. Not even in the slightest. I don't think it's a close call. But, you know, someone can give me their argument. I will listen otherwise.
Oh, you want me to argue with you?
No, I don't want, I never want to argue with Janelle. We're best friends. And then we await to see Nicole Kidman, Lady Gaga, and Rachel Zegler. And then of things that we have seen, women of color, Jennifer Hudson for Respect, which feels like 500 years ago. I adore Tessa Thompson in Passing.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
We still have Shantae Adams in A Journal for Jordan. There's, you know, one question mark at least. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few question marks out there. Yeah, and Halle Berry in Bruise. She is an Oscar winner, and she could direct herself to an Oscar. Who knows?
I'll just throw out Gemma Chan in Eternals. Well, I know it's a Marvel movie, but
go for
love
it.
Me
no,
some Gemma
no,
Chan.
That's what,
it's
that's
a Chloe Zhao film.
Need.
Let's see.
Do it.
Nothing would make me happier than that to just blow up and be like, oh, yeah, Gemma. First of all, Gemma Chan is like due for some love, and I'm waiting for her to get that role that like catapults her that way. And we also have not had a Asian woman nominated for lead actress ever.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Oh my God.
Ever. Ever. Forever. And then trying to see if there's anything else that's like in the, also a small movie, but I wish more people would see it. Natalie Morales in Language Lessons, which she,
oh, I loved
which she wrote
that
and directed.
Movie. Mm. Loved that movie.
Isn't it so sweet?
It's really clever. I was so over movies kind of made over Zoom. And first of all, it's not set in the pandemic. It's set over Zoom for a good reason, and it is so clever. And it just from scene to scene, I was just so fascinated by how they held my interest. And yeah, she's fantastic. Mark Duplass is fantastic. I really, really like that movie. Oh, let's not forget Taylor Page and Zola.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I don't think
can't
it's happening,
Zola.
But I love her. Love her.
I don't think so either. But you know, you know, people can hope and try. But again, like this becomes a conversation. Like there are candidates, but they don't look that way. Like we know, like I love Tessa Thompson, and I feel like if more people watched Passing, and it's not like overtly loud in a performance, it's subtle. It does a lot of things that, you know, quieter performances have a hard time. Jazz.
So I was just going to say, it's a beautiful film and it's a gorgeous like directorial debut from Rebecca Hall. But yeah, Tessa is, she'll steal your heart in this film.
Yeah.
Too late. She stole it long ago.
I know that's true. I've been in love with Tessa Thompson for quite some time. Now that we know that Katrina Balfe will be in supporting actress, as broken here this week, that Belfast, everyone's supporting except for Jude Hill. They let the kid go lead.
He is the lead, though, right? Like, normally...
Yes! It was 100% the right call.
It's for this.
100%. And thank you for saying Katrina Balfe's name correctly, because people
I believe
have not
it's
been...
Katarina.
Ooh. By the way, we're going to have her on the podcast soon. She taught me how to say Kieran Hines.
Kieran Hines, yeah. Kieran Hines.
Kieran. Like, Kieran. Like, it's up.
Here's breaking news. Judi Dench has never seen The Godfather.
Really?
The faces. If we could have screenshot your faces. I learned that yesterday in a panel
interesting.
With Jamie and Katrina.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, if Judy's nominated, she'll be the second oldest actress ever to be nominated for supporting actress.
I have a funny Judi Dench, Kenneth Branagh story, but I will save it for later because I feel like we're going to be talking about Belfast all season.
That's fine. All day.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll see you guys next week. We love you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Mike.
Bye. We miss you, Michael.
Schneider.
See you next week, Mike.
It's Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Clayton Davis. You know Oscar Isaac by his other names such as Poe Dameron, Llewyn Davis, Abel Morales, or who can forget the dance sensation himself that was Nathan. After the completion of the HBO limited series Scenes from a Marriage with Jessica Chastain, get ready to add two more to the list. The first as Duke Atreides, the leader of the Iraqis and father to Timothy Chalamet's Paul in Denis Villeneuve's Dune. The other as William Tell, an ex-military and gambling man who counts cards and has fantastic chemistry with his on-screen love interest, Tiffany Haddish, in Paul Schrader's The Card Counter.
And am I trying to justify what we did? No. Nothing. Nothing can justify what we did. Your father understood that. If you were there, you could understand. Otherwise, there is no understanding.
The Card Counter premiered at the Venice Film Festival before making a surprise stop at Telluride, where Latino actor Oscar Isaac picked up some major Oscar buzz for his performance in the film. Written and directed by famed Taxi Driver and Raging Bull scribe Paul Schrader, who received his first Oscar nomination for First Reformed, the buzz has been building for weeks for the film that's already opened in theaters. But before that, we begin our chat with Oscar Isaac talking about this moment in his career as one of the biggest stars in Hollywood and what it's been like for him post-Juilliard.
It's been really good. I was really happy just that these projects finally saw the light of day. You know, there was such a bottlenecking of things. So I know it feels like this guy's everywhere. It's so annoying, but that wasn't by design, you know? it's a really exciting thing because it's stuff that I'm really proud of and happy that I did and was longing for, you know, to be able to just kind of get back in the trenches with some real character studies and, you know, getting to work with, like you said, really amazing people. Jessica and I had been talking about doing something for a long time. And as soon as scenes came my way, I reached out to her before it was even mine. And I said, hey, this is out there. They're going to do this. I haven't gotten the offer on it, but I feel like if it happens, you know, it should be the two of us. And you know, the gods made sure that did happen. It was a powerful experience to shoot it, especially during COVID, you know, right in the thick of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the dream of working with Paul Schrader on The Card Counter, which, you know, that was a long time coming because it was one of my first auditions out of school 20 years ago was for Paul.
Oh.
It was in a strip mall somewhere in the valley. And he had like this black box theater that he had rented. And I showed up and auditioned, and he was sitting in the audience there. There was like little sets on the stage, and I got the part. It was for a movie called The Jesuit. And then I remember in his, you know, unconventional way, he sent me a DVD of all of the auditions, which was really weird. But then the movie didn't end up happening. I mean, eventually it did, and he didn't end up directing it. But it didn't happen for us, but we kept in touch. And I wrote to him after First Reformed, just saying how moved I was and how it was my favorite film of that year. And then a year later, he wrote to me saying, I have a script that I wrote for you. Well, not for you, but you're the first person I'm going to.
Yeah.
And then we
can keep that original story. Hey, you wrote it specifically for you. He wanted it for Oscar Isaac only.
I just love that he even writes it in the email, like teases me with, it's for me. But actually, you know what? Not really. Don't get a big hit. And then it ended up happening. So that was just it was a thrill. And it was that, you know, it was the kind of thing where he just lobbed up a whole world of a character to create. You know, it's like learning how to do cardistry with the cards, you know, learning about Leavenworth, taking penmanship courses. Cause I had the journal and I wanted this guy to write in a very controlled cursive, element after element that he just kind of lays out a playground, which was just so much fun.
They still hold penmanship courses because like Mike, I remember I just moved to LA in New Jersey. They stopped teaching cursive in public schools.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just did like a online one where I got sent the workbook and then just, okay. I did it as a daily practice. And I fell in love with it. Actually, it was such a,
has your autograph changed by the way now?
Yeah. It's a little extra loops in there.
It's awesome, man. All right, let's talk a little bit about let's go a little more in depth with Card Counter here, because you know, working with Paul Schrader, the guy who wrote Taxi Driver, you know, finally got his Oscar nomination for First Reformed, as you mentioned just recently. He's a legend in a lot of movie circles, and you know, isn't you get
crazy?
To
isn't that crazy? He wrote Raging Bull as well. He like and you know, it just goes to show you, it's just the fashion of awards, you know, it's like, it's about what's fashionable in the moment. And sometimes that lines up with what's great, you know?
Yep.
And oftentimes it's just, you know, it's just so much, it's very narrow.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you can't love awards like I do without having snubs. Yet, listen, that's why I love you so much, because inside Llewyn Davis, I'm just put out there, someone has your Oscar, and it's that year, so I'm just going to put it out there. But no, so we're going with Paul Schrader, and then we're going with Tiffany Haddish, man. You two, on paper, like, I was like, that's not going to work. And then you guys are just dancing together, it feels like. How are you? First of all, are you guys best friends today? Because I feel like you guys are.
You know, and, we've had some like really great talks. Like yeah, a couple months ago, we talked for like an hour on the phone. I was in Budapest, and you know, she was out in LA, and we connected again, and it was really special. She even like recommended a couple books for me to read, and I read them, and like they really helped and changed my life in some ways. And you know, she's such a special person, which obviously is not news to anyone.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's like, I feel like that must've been like what meeting Jesus was like, you know, but you know, it's like someone that you're just like, yeah, I'll drop everything. I'll just follow you, because you just exude life and light and authenticity. And so I was so, so excited when Paul keyed in on her for the role. Just also because it just makes my character looked like such more like a badass, you know, that you can nab her, you know?
Yeah.
And I enjoyed working with her so much. I can't say enough about how much I love Tiff.
That's awesome, man.
She's so sexy.
Oh my God. Yes. Like just like, it's, like the chemistry between you two is just like, it's unreal. It's like bouncing off the screen. It's so well done.
I'm glad you feel that.
You know, you're doing the card counter. What kind of research did you do for the role? Because I do you know how to count cards at all now? Have you tried?
Well, this is what I was saying. Like, it wasn't even about, you know, so the audience believes, but it's about me believing it. Like, what do I need to do to believe myself as this character? And so cardistry, you know, not card counting, because you can't show card counting, you know, but, and also, you know, that ends up being more of a metaphor than a literal thing, because he does a bit of blackjack, but then it transitions into poker. But really, it's about the nature of waiting and counting the days and the minutes and the hours and living in this purgatory. But I met with some really great cardistry experts, just so it looks like this is someone that has spent 10 years of his life just solely messing around with cards and learning what a deck is and how to cheat basically. So I did a lot of that. Like I said, the penmanship was a huge thing for me. It was part of a daily practice. I, you know, playing someone that is this emotionally isolated and disconnected, I went back to school with Moni Akeem, my old teacher from Juilliard, and we did a bunch of neutral mask work. Because, you know, Paul mentioned, you know, this is someone wearing a mask and the mask is their profession. But I was like, what if I take that literally? What if I actually work with a mask and like I do the cards and like what are things that can be expressed through the body that take away this, you know, very intense tool, the face? And so we played around with how his body shifts from when he's in his purgatory, aimless, to when he is ignited by this new objective, by this new idea of hope, and how does his body movements change? And so that was something that we worked with a lot. And I'm happy that when I see the film, I see that. I see the guy seems like he's made out of marble and moving, and also at the same time just floating through these weird spaces in these casinos, and how suddenly that shifts.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Like and looking at your career, because you're a Juilliard grad and you know, been a great journeyman actor up until this now leading man status, which has been again incredible to see again for a Latino, because we don't see enough of us on screen.
Ooh,
have you felt that kind of blood, sweat, and tears, like hard work to get here? Like when you look back at that time of struggling to get to this point, does it still stick out like, yeah, that was hard?
You know who I saw? I was at the Succession premiere last night, and I saw Kevin Bray there. He he was, I always fucking love seeing that guy. He cast me in my first speaking role in All About the Benjamins in like 1996 or 97, you know?
2002, actually. Well, that's when it came out.
That's when it came out, but we shot it in like, we shot it in like 90, maybe 98 or whatever.
Yeah.
I think, but I don't know. It all gets mished around. But anyway, you know, to see him there was amazing because it's just a reminder of like, man, I've been at this for a long time, you know? And yeah, I did a movie and then I didn't work for 2 years, you know, I was like desperately trying to find my way. And so to feel like an internal settling in my soul as well, not just because like I achieved the thing, but I understand myself better as well, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that desperation to be seen, which, you know, I had since I was a little boy.
Yeah.
You know, that has shifted into just a more of a curiosity of the craft. And, you know, this idea of like something to prove has gone away for me. And I think that's actually making for more interesting work.
Yeah, awesome. It's good. It's good to hear. Let's go to this little cheap movie that got made called Dune, right? It's like $20 budget here. It's also fantastic and you're great in it.
Thank you.
Denis Villeneuve, I think, is top five guys working today. Like he is. He's on it right now. Did you see the original and how did you prep for this? Because there are Dune heads out there that are going to be really meticulous about what Denny brings to the story.
Well, luckily, like my dearest friends are all nerds. So my best friend is a Dune head and has been a Dune head his entire life. And so he was like my go-to source about things. Because at the beginning, Denis called me and he's like, I'm doing Dune. I want you to be in it. I'm not sure what role, you know? And so I immediately, you know, I'd read the book a long time ago but I called my friend. And I'm like, hey dude, what should I be? Who should I be in this thing? Like, I think there's a few things that could be interesting. Do you think I should be Duke Leto? Should you think I should be Gurney? Should you, you know, this was because this was early days before he'd gotten his amazing cast. And it really did feel like, yeah, I'm the Duke. Like that's, you know, it's like, even when you read him, the way he's described, you know, it's like this kind of darker olive skin and these like, you know, cheekbones and there's something, you know, hawk-like about him. And, you know, it appealed to my sense of tragedy as well. And, you know, I just felt for him. And so, and I liked the arc that he plays. And also it allowed me to come into a world and exit that world and not be, you know, as much as I love it now, of course, I'm like, come on, can he come back as like a force ghost or something like that? just because
Force dyad, it can come right back, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so that all of that is what appealed to me, but really it was Denis, you know, I mean, I've been talking to him for a long time. We've become friends. And I remember when it was announced, I wrote to him, like, hey, here you're doing Dune. I'm a big fan of it. He's like, oh, you're a big fan of Dune. Interesting. That was the only email back.
Leaving you at the edge of your seat. You're like, I don't know. Did I just mess this up? Is this over?
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's too enigmatic. But no, it was just such a great opportunity. And really what was such a wonderful surprise was a relationship that Timmy and I cultivated together, you know, because there's this thing, it just speaks to what a talented actor he is. It's like a very basic acting thing where it's like the king doesn't tell the audience who the king is. The court tells the audience who the king is, right? Mm-hmm. It's how everybody else around him acts that lets people know who's the status. And Timmy immediately like went into the role of, this is my dad who I love more than anything, you know? And so he kind of allowed that dynamic to really flourish in a beautiful way. And then he and I just became really good friends. We were playing music all the time. And, what I'm referring to specifically in the scenes themselves. And, I just thought that was just a really special thing. Cause I feel like
you can believe that dynamic when you see it on screen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And
that has a lot to do. I'd say that's like 80% on Timmy.
And you're his dad. Like you're Timmy's dad in the movie. Like it's such a crazy good. I mean, you're 42 years old.
Yeah.
And Timmy's like 25 or whatever he is. And also too talented for his own good. He needs to be brought down a notch regardless. But yeah, like you guys, I really believe the father-son dynamic. I didn't think I would.
Yeah. I didn't either.
It's good to know. We all came back. All right. Let's go a little bit into, you know, a little bit of a career retrospective here. You know, Drive, I think is when people at large, masses started really noticing you. Inside Llewyn Davis, as I said, your Oscar miss that I'll hate forever. The first team up with Jessica Chastain in the Isaac Chastain universe of A Most Violent Year. Another great, fantastic performance. And then obviously all the Star Wars films. What do you find yourself attracted to right now? What kind of characters are you seeking? Are you even seeking any characters?
You know what? It was actually talking to Willem Dafoe about this. And he put it in a way that it's like I've made it so my own, because it's just a great way of thinking about it, because it can be so hard, man. It can be so hard to like figure out what to do, you know? And the biggest commodity now is time, especially when you've got kids and a family and, you know, time, you'd never get that back, and you can never get that doesn't get added to your bank account, you know? And so it becomes really difficult, because it's like, also I've spent, like, you know, as we were just saying, like the blood, sweat and tears, I've spent, let's say, 30 years trying to have people say yes, you know, and like kind of getting the shot and trying and like finding and being like, okay, no, this is I can do something with this. I can do something with this. I can. And it's been a very small window of saying no to stuff. And it still feels very weird to pass on things that I would have been, even just a few years ago, but insane to say no.
Yeah.
But because, you know, it's like the priorities have to shift, you know, as one gets older and hopefully more mature, and one wants to be a father that's there. So that's been hard. But anyway, it's about, is there space to do something? It's not even like, is the character great? Is the director great? Is the script great? It's like, do I have room and the space to make something happen, to do something that means something to me? And so I've been kind of looking at it that way, you know, and I think that that's a bit more of an honest approach, because it's less external, you know, it's more about the internal feeling of like, yeah, this gives me the space to do something that means something to me and will be worth perhaps the pain of being away for a bit to express something that means something to me. You know?
That's awesome. This is really weird to ask, but the role of being a dad, how has that changed you in this time now? Like, you know, like if you had made it to this point pre-child, would you have been different? Do you think that this happened? I'm going to get really spiritual, but do you think that's all part of the God plan for you?
It happened? I want to believe that, because I think that, honestly, if this kind of stuff had, if this amount of, you know, work was coming towards me, I think I could have easily gone into burnout mode pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And probably burnt out everybody else on me if I'm not doing that already. You know what I'm saying? It's just, it's like, I think of the Brando thing. He's like, you know, I've got like 10 faces I make, you know, like, I can't let everybody know all my faces too soon.
Yeah.
So, I think I'm happy, because it allows for a lot of perspective.
That's awesome. We are in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month right now. Yeah. And recent study came out about Latinos, non-shocker, not being in a lot of movies over the last 13 years.
Yeah.
You know, Latinos are in less than 4% of movies. Out of 53,000 speaking roles examined over the last 13 years, less than 4% had speaking parts, not even like leads, just speaking parts. Mm-hmm. And you know,
less than 4%.
Afro-Latinos of all movies examined in the last 13 years, 6 had leading roles. Mm-hmm. It is just an awful thing to know. Things that we know because we don't see it, but mm-hmm. as someone that is one of the, you know, one of the greats right now working in the business that a lot of little Latino kids are looking up to, what do you say to something like that? What do you see in the industry right now, and what would you like to see change with growth?
Well, obviously, I'd love to see a lot more, you know, great Latino actors out there, you know, getting their shot and getting a platform, getting a space to do something great, you know. And there are those champions like, you know, like Lin-Manuel and, you know, these amazing people that come around but are so few, right? I obviously want to see more of that. You know, we do have some incredible Latino directors out there, you know. I mean, you've got one of those posters right back there, you know, which is great. You know, and what a beautiful movie that was too. Yeah. So. Yeah, but I agree, you know, like there's also, it does feel like it's also quite, in a way, segregated too. You know, it's like you've got like the Latinos that'll be make the Latino movie, and then, you know, and then that's it. And then maybe they can have like one little speaking part in the white people movie, you know? And, you know, so that relegation I'd like to see broken apart a bit more too, yeah. You know? And it's a challenging time though too, because it's like, you know, it's like the representation thing obviously is important, but I know for me, what I found really moving was not necessarily my personal story being represented, but what I found really moving was someone that was Latino that was being allowed to do everything, you know, like that meant everything to me. Like when I found out Raul Julia originated Betrayal on Broadway, mm-hmm. you know, as like an English guy, like that was the, you know, Harold Pinter's play with the first time it ever premiered in the United States was with a fucking Puerto Rican playing that role. You know, like, well, that meant so much to me, much more than like, what, you know, than seeing a play about like, you know, the Cuban refugees, which is important, you know, and I get it. But it's like, it's so much more than that, you know, and what our contributions to this country are so much more than that too, you know, and what we're able to do is just as human beings. So I like that excites me a lot, you know, seeing Latinos being able to play all sorts of roles and not just relegated to like, you know, these very specific stories that, you know, that feel in a way quite confining.
Yeah. Thank you so much for saying that. That's been my point. I've been like pounding on the wall. Some people like, it's not Latinos just playing, you know, doing Latino stories. We want, yeah, it's why I talk about as president of Latino Entertainment Journalists Association, people will say, well, you have to review more Latino movies. Like, yes, we do want to review that, but we want to tell you that we can review any movie. We can talk about any movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Our points of view. Yeah. They shouldn't just be relegated to like that little sidebar, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like how do we do that? And I think Lynn has been great at doing that, you know, by basically blowing up American history in that way, you know, and it's just like, yeah. So I think that's really important. And then also just like championing Latino voices, you know.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. I want to ask for your take on something. You know, IATSE, you know, we may be headed towards a strike, and that is, you know, workers on the set there before you get there, after you get there, a lot of them tend to be Latinos also working in that space. What is your take on this whole IATSE situation, and what should Hollywood be doing to rectify it?
Full support. It's staggering. I mean, the amount of abuse that I've seen on sets, you know, where it's like, we could be up on this mountain that's like totally perilous and dangerous, and the sun's going down. It's like, okay, guys, go. And then the sun's gone. And then it's like, you just have a whole crew up there trying to bring down lights and bring down stuff, and no one gives a shit, you know? And it's, I've seen a lot of that. So I think it's way past time that something's done to really back up the people that are, you know, allowing for these movies to get made. I mean, it's like the,
it's critical and just as important as any actor or producer for sure on those sets.
Thank you. My last bit of a big question for you, because I'm gonna get a lot of crap if I don't ask it. Just wrapped a little movie called Moon Knight.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously you can tell me everything that happens in it and where it's headed, but interesting is just, you know, comparing how the MCU operates to you know, Star Wars and more, like how is that different, and what can you tell me about it, because you filmed it in Budapest?
Yeah. Well, there's not much, obviously, I can say, man. So you know that, right? But
you did say you could tell me the end part, like what happens at the end
apart
and how
from it the ends. Yeah. Apart from the plot, I can't really say much.
Okay.
No, it's totally different for me too. But like, this is also the first time I'm leading something this massive as well. You know, you know, being an executive producer on it, doing that whole thing, it's what it allowed is exactly what I was hoping for. It was a big risk for me, you know, and it was really a hard decision, because again, it was like, am I going to throw myself back into one of these big machines, and what is that going to mean? And I love this director, you know, this Mohamed Diab, you know, I love the movies that he's made, and this is, you know, a big shot for him, and I like the way he's talking about this. Speaking with Kevin, you know, when I had those conversations and I came in with some pretty big ideas as well. And it was kind of like, look, I'm going to come in with these big ideas, and if they don't like them, that's totally fair. And at least we'll know. And we're not going to be in a situation where we're fighting and doing this. And because that would just be a killer situation. Like, that'd be awful. And immediately we just were seeing it all really eye to eye. And the more I investigated the story, the more I was moved by it. And also the more I found so much room to do things that I've never done before. And I've been curious about and wanted to. So what ended up happening was that every single morning when that alarm would go off, I could not wait to get to set. And it was the biggest workload I've ever had in my career. The biggest, the most challenging as far as just the sheer amount of stuff we had to do and try to get done in an 8-month period. And even yet, even with all that, the challenges of that, I just couldn't wait to get to set and to work with Ethan Hawke and Mae Calloway. You know, we were just like this trifecta, this unit, and Mohammed and, Benson and Moorhead, you know, they were so fantastic too. And just like, I couldn't believe my luck, you know, and how collaborative the situation was. So I'm really excited and hopeful, you know. I don't know if it'll work. We took some big swings, you know, and even Kevin's like, I don't like to count my chickens before they're hatched. I'm feeling good, but you never know, you know? hopefully it'll look as good as it felt.
Yeah, good. Listen, you and Ethan Hawke, by the way, when I say you and Tiffany Haddish didn't make sense on paper, you and Ethan Hawke do. Like, I was like, that hasn't happened yet? Like, that's crazy.
He literally lives right down the street
from me. Like, does he? Oh, well, you guys are hanging out all the time now, so that's good. You could do more movies. Actually, let me ask you, what's next on the docket for you? Because, you know, now people want more Oscar Isaac, and just like, you know, there was a nude scene in Scenes from a Marriage, and that's been very topic.
And in Dune, I get pretty naked.
But barely though. Okay, can I just say, I was sitting with my friend Rosie Cordero, and she said, "How are you going to just tease upper leg of Oscar Isaac and not go full frontal?" But then she didn't know Scenes from Marriage was coming, so that works.
There you go. There she got. She got it there.
Yeah. Boy, are you working on next?
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. Not going to do anything. So hang out for a little while.
So I have a graphic novel coming out called Head Wounds.
Ooh.
Yeah.
When's that out?
Legendary. I think it might be coming out either at the end of this year or towards the beginning of next year. Brian Bucciolato wrote it, and Christian Ward, who's an incredible artist. I mean, he's just about finished drawing this thing, and it's just astounding, the artwork. And it's been a labor of love that I made with one of the guys from my old band. Two of the guys from my old band, they kind of came up with the concept and the story. And so really excited about that coming out.
Oh, that's awesome.
As far as movies and that, I'm just kind of like letting things simmer for a bit. Going to be, a human being for a bit, home with my boys.
Yeah.
Do that.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, listen, you're making us proud. You're making everyone proud. You're killing it. So I'm just so glad to see you working as much as you do, man. And please do another musical, man. Or an album, something. Like the voice is there. We need more Oscar Isaac tunes.
Oh, dude, I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. Listen, congratulations on everything. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Likewise. Congrats with everything.
That's Oscar Isaac. Scenes from Marriage is currently streaming on HBO Max. The Card Counter is currently open in theaters, and Dune opens in theaters and debuts on HBO Max October 22nd. After the break, we are joined by Jeffrey Wright, star of The French Dispatch. From Los Angeles, this is Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jeffrey Wright has been working for decades with memorable roles in films such as Shaft, Broken Flowers, and the Hunger Games franchise. And who can forget his Emmy-nominated turn in HBO's Westworld? He's currently co-starring in two movies in 2021. One is his beloved Felix Leiter, the swan song of Daniel Craig as James Bond in the film No Time to Die. The other, he's playing Roebuck Wright, a food journalist based on an amalgamation of James Baldwin and A.J. Liebling in Searchlight Pictures' The French Dispatch. The film debuted at the Cannes Film Festival, and for his hilarious and scene-stealing turn, he's receiving some supporting actor buzz, which could bring him his long-overdue first Oscar nomination. Here with Jeffrey Wright, star of The French Dispatch from Wes Anderson. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm good. Probably better if I stop crunching ice.
Listen, we're in Telluride. We're thirsty.
Got to hydrate.
You got to hydrate.
Got to hydrate in the altitude.
Thanks for taking this time with me today. Just really big fan of you and everything that you've done up to this point, and including French Dispatch.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, I want to start with how'd you get wrapped up in Wes Anderson's world? Because you are not someone I would think would be in a Wes Anderson movie. I feel like, there's Wes Andersonism people that usually go into Wes Anderson movies, and it didn't seem like it was your, I would have never thought it.
Well, he certainly has kind of a company of actors that he has worked with over the last years, and this is my first time being in one of his films. But I absolutely love his work. I think there's a number of things about his signature that really kind of align with work that I've done. One is the theatricality of his work and the non-hyper-realistic way in which he tells story, in which he directs actors. And that's something that I've always admired or was drawn to as a performer. And I think that has to do with coming out of the theater. But also it has to do with the actors that I was interested in and inspired by as a youngin, folks like Dustin Hoffman and actors who came out of the theater and, translated that onto film. I think there's a good fit, really. And it's funny, when I first, when I talked to Wes about this project and other things, I realized that he had seen not only films that I'd done, but he'd been to a number of plays that I've been in. And I was like, really, really, dude, you were there. You didn't come say hello, but he'd seen pretty much everything. And so I guess he wanted to invite me into this circle, and he did so with this piece, which he says that he wrote with me in mind. So,
well, that's awesome. Your career, you've run the gamut. You've worked with some of the best, like Soderbergh. You've worked with George Clooney, Siriana. Going through your first major roles with Harrison Ford in Presumed Innocent.
Well, that's not quite a major role. That role I
described. You're in it. I can see you.
No, I'm a bearded blur. If you can catch me in that movie, you're very good. That was the first feature film that I worked on. I'd actually done a kind of quasi-documentary in D.C. that we shot in the White House in 1987, after I'd gotten out of college. And something, and I played this Friedman who was an artisan working on carpets or something like that. I don't know what happened in this movie. I don't know where it is, but that was the first thing I ever did. And then Presumed Innocent came a little bit later. But no, I'm not. I'll give anyone a fake dollar if they can find me in that movie. But it was a great experience. I worked on that for about 2 weeks, and it was a really cool introduction into set world and filmmaking. Had an opportunity to kind of observe Harrison Ford for some time and Alan Pakula, and just understood something about like the culture of filmmaking that was really cool. I remember he showed up for the first rehearsal. I'm sitting next to Harrison. I'm like, this is Harrison Ford, one of the biggest cats in the whole thing, and I'm sitting here, I think I had a Subway token to get back home with him. It was like, I was about 21 years old, but that was good fun. But anyway, yeah, okay.
It's cool, man. We're gonna it's a contest. Everyone needs to go and tweet out the Jeffrey Wright picture from Presumed Innocent.
Yeah, have fun.
Let's go to your role as Roebuck Wright in French Dispatch, kindred spirit of James Baldwin. It's really... seems to be emulating. How did you prep for the role? How did you, get ready for it?
Well, it's an homage to James Baldwin. When I first met Wes, he described to me this character and this story. And so he said, it's a little bit James Baldwin, maybe a little Tennessee Williams, and a lot of A.J. Liebling, who was his food critic for The New Yorker. So, the guy that we came up with is kind of a Frankensteinian amalgamation of things. Not James Baldwin, but not biographical by any stretch of the imagination. That wasn't the intent. But at the same time, he is an expat in the 50s in France, in this fictional town, Ennuis-sur-Blasé. So for the question is, how do I justify this character in this place at that time? And so you go to Baldwin. Baldwin's, the prime example of a black American gay man, expat, leaving the States to find a new type of freedom, to find, if he can, a certain type of wholeness. And so that was the inspiration. It wasn't like trying to recreate James Baldwin, and certainly in the writing, because the Roebuck tends to focus now on food or at this time, So that's, that's the Liebling side of things. And
by the way, you're going to start a podcast about food, like just describing food.
Oh,
like,
could be.
You should. It is like music to my ears, whole sequence.
Cool.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I dig a good meal, But that too was like part of the attraction of this script, because it was so delicious. The descriptions were so delicious, and the language was so lyrical and poetical, and I just loved the architecture of the storytelling. I really felt when I read it was one of the most beautiful pieces that anyone had ever offered me to play. And so yes, there's some hints of Baldwin, and for in obvious ways, but there's a lot of other spices and flavors thrown in as well.
Oh, awesome! So about the great people you work with, obviously the film is told in three separate sequences, anthology. Did you get to see any of the other actors from the other sequences, like Benicio del Toro, Francis McDormand, Timothy Chalamet?
Yeah, I never saw Benicio. No. I don't know when the last time I've seen Benicio. No, we didn't. We didn't. We
you
missed
guys
each
worked other before on Bus.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
In,
yeah,
in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's the.
Is this your first time in a movie?
I guess that's the first. This is the first movie since. Yeah, yeah, man. But we missed each other by a couple of days. But yeah, they were, you know, it's a big ensemble, so people were kind of crisscrossing, and then there is like the gathering in certain scenes where many of the writers are together, so obviously we were all there. Yeah, it was, I was in Angoulême, France, for I guess about a month working on this, and it was been a while, so my memory is not as clear as it might have been. We shot this in spring of 2019, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, just
and the world
just
wasn't on fire.
Yeah.
It was just a good time.
It was simmering.
Yeah. Yeah. God. Yeah, actually, speaking of just like kind of time and just how that's worked, you know, about the same time as Presumed Innocent, I think you shot No Time to Die, right? Around that time, because we're still waiting for it.
Presumed Innocent, you mean French Dispatch?
No, I was about No Time, the upcoming James Bond movie.
About the same time, yeah. Yeah. So, yes, that's right. Yeah, so I shot this French Dispatch in spring of 2019, and then I went back to Westworld shortly after that. It gave me a little bit of a break from Westworld to go shoot Bond, and I came back to Westworld, and then when we finished Westworld in October, I went back and finished up Bond because Daniel had gotten hurt during one sequence, and so we had to go back and revisit some stuff.
So then you can't talk crap. You have to get beat up, and then he has to stop filming. That's what the joke we were making, that he got beat up on set.
Oh, that no.
I know he formally got hurt. It was a rough shoot, I think.
Yeah, no, it was. I was actually there. I wasn't filming that day, but I happened by set that day, and it was just, it's tricky stuff when you do these types of films, you know, because you're doing sequences. Certain stunt sequences or certain kind of, you know, active or action sequences, and you do them repeatedly. And it was a pretty simple thing. He was running down a gangplank onto this where this seaplane was awaiting, and he just, you know, I don't know how many times he was doing that, and it was kind of a wobbly wooden thing, and he took a wrong step, and it was like, wasn't a good take.
One other big highlight from your career, it's all the accolades you've received. You have a Tony, you have a Golden Globe, and you have an Emmy for your role as Belize in Angels in America, which is just, we don't, and as a film award, as awards editor at Variety, it's always great to see representation anywhere we can find it, but it's also well-deserved. Can you recall that time, because obviously you've received many nominations since then, but that the symbolism of that moment, do you still remember it fondly?
With Angels?
Or just winning the Emmy, like getting that recognition.
Winning the Emmy, yeah, that was all kind of a blur to me. I don't know why. I mean, I'd won the Tony about 10 years before, and that really was kind of a pretty big milestone in my career, I guess, because it was pretty early on, and I had been acting in the theater for about 7 years, and I'd done a couple films here and there. I'd done a film with Sidney Poitier, a miniseries with Sidney Poitier. I'd done some other TV, and Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, but largely theater. And the reason being is because I hadn't really started acting until I was, pretty late in the thing. I was late in my years at college, so I didn't really know what the hell I was doing, and I needed to figure it out. So I went to NYU for a couple of months to grad school on the Zelda Fitch Handler, who ran Arena Stage in D.C., who gave me my first job there, was also running the theater program at Tisch, and she gave me a you know, a full ride to come up there. And I went up and I stayed for a couple of months because the play that I'd done in D.C. at Arena was going to Boston, maybe coming to New York. So I wanted to do that. Lorraine Hansberry's last play. So anyway, long story short, I went to do that. And that I left school and it started like this, you know, path of like 7 years of theater to learn what it was to be an actor. That culminated with Angels in America. That's, you know, 7 years later, I was on Broadway doing that. And it was the first time in the midst of working on that play that I said to myself, okay, I'm an actor now.
That's when it clicked.
Yeah, it was only at that point. And then some months later, I won the Tony. And there was a lot of stuff going on in my life at that time as well. That was a pretty significant, like, I guess, rite of passage for me. So that one really, you know, that one kind of sticks out among the others. And, you know, that one's kind of hard. It's hard to get. it takes a lot of sweat, you know, on that stage to get one of those things. So I guess, yeah, if there is one, it's that one.
By the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't get to mention, I forgot you also worked with Bill Murray in one of my favorite performances from you in Broken Flowers.
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch. Like, that was, I think it was one of the first times I think I like knew you, because I like you, I'm late to the game of, like, you know, I've loved movies my whole life, but I don't think I call myself a cinephile. Mm-hmm. Like I've had to catch up on a lot of things. One of my shticks is a shtick, and it's a little badge of you know, shame. I haven't seen Casablanca. I will watch it.
Oh goodness,
it's kind of my thing right now, and I'm gonna watch it.
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up with, like, you know, Kurosawa and all those guys. I had to find them in college. What did you study in college? You went to Amherst.
I went to Amherst. I studied political science. So,
what was the plan then?
I guess maybe law school. My mom was a lawyer. You know, I grew up about in D.C. around, you know, it was like a lawyer. You bump into a lawyer on every, you know, on every street corner. So, yeah, I think that was the idea. And I've, you know, you in D.C., you know, politics is kind of in your blood. So maybe I was thinking something in some way, not, you know, non-specific. But, I was always drawn to issues involving legislation and law, and I was curious about the workings of government and the impact of government on lives. And I was, you know, kind of to an extent because of that, I guess, because of growing up there and growing up, you know, in my mother's house, I kind of see everything through a political prism. Yeah. To some extent, maybe to a fault. So that, you know, that was the idea. But I actually the guy who was the actor in my class in school in D.C. is now, ironically, a senator. He's a senator from Colorado, in fact, Michael Bennett. He was doing Eugene O'Neill and things like that in school, and I wasn't. I didn't do any acting at all. I was kind of afraid of it. You know, I was doing other things, playing lacrosse and football and stuff, but I didn't start acting until I got to college.
So you guys swapped places. Yeah, you know, be a senator. And he could have been an actor.
Yeah, no, I will gladly leave that work to him right now. Gladly. Thank you, Michael. Yeah. Well, carry on.
Thank you for your service, Michael. You really helped out here. Social media will get mad at me if I just don't ask, and I know that you can't say much, so I just figured I'd ask you anyway. Can you tell us the end of the Batman, or anything that's happening with the Batman?
The end of the Batman?
What happens at the end? Like, what's that whole story about? Tell us something so big.
Ruin the movie for everyone.
Is there anything you could share about the Batman? Because you're James Gordon.
Yes. It's a throwback movie in many ways. I think it's a very different film than, you know, we've seen of the films from, you know, this comic book genre that we're in right now. And I think it's going to be like kind of a refreshing rethinking of the genre. And I say it's a throwback because it's a real movie. Cool, man. It's, you know, it's
wow. That was Jeffrey Wright, one of the stars of The French Dispatch, opening in theaters on October 22nd. No Time to Die is currently in theaters. And that's it for this edition of the Variety's Award Circuit podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Oscar predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Janelle Riley, and Michael Schneider, I'm Clayton Davis. We'll see you on the circuit.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.